without clergy, judge, or jury. The story of the Scariff Martyrs. A documentary from Scariff Bay Community Radio. Part 2 of 2.
In the winter of 1920, as the War of Independence raged in Ireland, shocking events were unfolding in a corner of East Clare. Three IRA volunteers involved in an attack on the RIC barracks in Scariff have been on the run for 2 months. On the 16th of November at Williamstown, a unit of auxiliaries dispatched from Killaloe capture Alfie Rogers, Michael Brod McMahon and Martin Gilday. Michael Egan, a civilian, is also arrested. Williamstown man Tommy Holland takes up the story.
Now, the rest of the soldiers then, some stayed on the boat, some stayed mine, and the three captured, there was three boys, three Scariff men, and Michael Egan was minded on the boat, and they went out and searched the fields, the rest of the soldiers. They captured the two Conwells, then they came up and they raided our house, they raided Nutgrove. They knew everything about them because the day before, when they were winnowing the corn or taking the wheels off of the trap, a man came into the yard and nobody talked to him. And when they went into the supper that night, some of my father and uncle said, where did your man that came into the yard go? But nobody had met him. He left again. We presume and we know they were spied on.
This is the testimony of John Conway, who gives his account of events of that fateful day.
On Tuesday, November the 16th, 1920, I'll never forget it. My brother Michael, my mother and myself had our dinner at about 12 o'clock. Meek left to get Meek Egan to put a handle in the hatchet and I went out to cut scallops. I went along the road towards Williamstown House and walked down right into the arms of the Oxies. They were dressed in plain clothes and spoke with English accents. I never expected them, for I heard no lorries. They questioned me about the IRA and the strangers who had been staying about the place. They searched me and found a bottle of milk in my pocket and tried to make me say that I was bringing it to the strangers. I had it for myself, but when I wouldn't say I had it for the boys, they marched me away down to the pier where I saw the commissioner's boat. On the deck, I saw Mike Egan tied up with his own ass reins. Young Rogers, McMahon and Gilday were tied up in the same way with the thick boat ropes. My brother Mick was also there, but he wasn't tied. There was about 25 Oxies, and Joe McAvoy, Frank Shoulders the engineer, and Joe Hogan the deckhand on board as well. A bitter northeasterly breeze was blowing when the boat started off from the pier. We were all on deck. The Oxies were questioning us the whole way down, and Alfie Rogers, Brod McMahon and Martin Gilday kept saying to them that Mike Egan was not to blame. 'Twas duskish when we arrived at the jetty at the Lakeside Hotel. My brother Mick and I were put down the hatch, and the other four were taken to the hotel. From the time they left the boat until we saw them again, Egan and Gilday looked like dead men. They were that shook and pale. As we came in, Oxies in uniform took them out of the day room one by one. They kept them out a good long time. Alfie Rogers was the last to be brought back, and he was pumping blood from the nose and face. I'd say he had lost all his blood before he was shot at all. McMahon was very, very quiet. They had more in for Rogers and McMahon than the others. Mick and myself were taken out then into a small room where the colonel, Andrews was his name, I think, cross-questioned us and threatened us. He showed us revolvers and ammunition and said that they were found with the lads. He tried to get us to say that we were friends of Mike Egan and that we knew the lads had been staying in Williamstown House for the last 3 weeks. We had nothing to tell him unless we started telling him lies. I had bad old shoes on me, and one of the Oxies said that anyone would know from our dress that we weren't Sinn Féiners. The colonel asked us then if we had cigarettes, and he gave us up to 50 between us. We were brought back to the day room and they gave us a good meal. As we were brought in, The four boys were taken out. We were given blankets and brought to a small empty room. We sat on the blankets. There was an awful hullabaloo away at the other end of the passage, shouting and roaring and dancing and drunken men singing when Irish eyes are smiling.
Dr. Tomás McComara, oral historian and author of The Scariff Martyrs, War, Murder and Memory in East Clare.
You see, when we consider what happened on the Bridge of Killaloe on the 16th of November, it's really important to consider the sources of information that we have to establish what happened. We have an official account, which is within the British Military Court of Inquiry that took place afterwards. And that forms the basis of the press attention and the press reporting and the discussions within the House of Commons from the point of view of the British government. But then you have this immediately developing alternative account, you know, formed on the basis of local knowledge, local oral recollections, and from the perspective of common logic as well, and the patterns of British behaviour at the time. So what we know officially from the point of view of the British Military Court of Inquiry, which takes place on the 18th, 2 days after the incident on the bridge, a number of people give evidence to that, who testified that they were present on the bridge that night, and they describe how they're bringing the four prisoners, and they describe them as four IRA prisoners, to the Bridge of Killaloe, that when they get to the bridge, that the four prisoners make a combined attempt to escape, that they're called on to halt, and when they don't halt, that they're shot, and that they die immediately. That is the official account given by the British authorities. They claim that it happened sometime between 11:30 and 12 a.m.
The Chief Secretary to Ireland, Hammer Greenwood, offers the British defence for the killings.
In reference to this tragedy, the police and military were surely entitled to fire on prisoners who were attempting to escape and who refused to halt when called upon.
Now, that account, I don't think anybody has ever taken that seriously at a local level. The Court of Inquiry sat and agreed with it and signed it off. It was sent to Victoria Barracks, where that was signed off. Hammer Greenwood, when he received it over in London, he defended that position. So that became the official accepted position of what took place that night, that they were shot attempting to escape. That tells us that there were Black and Tans and RIC involved in the shooting of the Scariff Martyrs. So the official account tells us that it wasn't the auxiliaries, it was the Black and Tans and the RIC, Irish members of the RIC, who shot the Scariff Martyrs. There are a number of sources that support an alternative account. If we break it down according to common logic, the notion that they were attempting to escape was the pattern right across the country. There had been over 112 people killed in similar circumstances. There was 11 killed within that week in the same way, a shot attempting to escape. You know, all IRA volunteers or activists would be quite aware that if you did run, you know, you were signing your own death warrant, that there would be often occasions where it would be made possible for you to run, to encourage to run, in order to create the excuse for shooting. So that is difficult to substantiate, you know, from that point of view, because the pattern is elsewhere. And this is said in the British House of Commons. There's another argument around it whereby the British suggest that they're not handcuffed, and this is countered by various sources. John Conway, who's, you know, brought on the boat with them, he claims that he saw Martin Gilday in handcuffs after he shot. There's plenty of evidence to show that they would have been handcuffed, and logic would dictate that they would have been handcuffed if you're bringing IRA prisoners across a bridge as well. There's also the oral recollections of people who were close to the bridge that night who claimed that they heard intermittent shooting for a long period of time with groans and screams of the prisoners as well. So that is clearly contradicts the notion that they were shot attempting to escape and died immediately, which is the contention of the British official account. So there are all of these contradictions to the official account that are embedded within the local tradition and local insight, which make it very difficult to believe that official account. What I would suggest is I think it possibly can go further to the point where I think it is likely there were far more British forces on the bridge that night than what the official military account suggests. And I would think it is highly unlikely that only seven members of the RIC and Black and Tans went to escort four IRA men, as they described them, across the bridge that night.
We return to the testimony of John Conway.
Suddenly the door was burst in on us and Oxies shouted at us to get up quick. Each of us was marched between two Oxies. I was up first, up to the bridge. The bridge was packed with Oxies, Tans and Peelers. We were marched across it. I hadn't gone very far when the Oxy flashed a light and told me to walk over the body. Stiff, he called it. I knew it was the body of one of the four boys. About 20 yards on, there was another, and then another. The lash body was right over the canal arch. There was a crossly tender at Shannon View Hotel with its lights on facing us, and I saw by its light that Martin Gilday was dead. He was handcuffed and his face was bloody. We were halted near the tender. The tens used to come over to us, look into our faces and threaten us. While there, we saw them throw the body of Martin Gilday into the back of the tender, just like you'd throw in a dead pig.
Now you've had the treatment of the prisoners, now it's the treatment of their bodies, and that's another injury to the broader community. So it shifts on then where they're taken up to the RAC barracks in Killaloe, and that moves on to the next phase of the story. On the night of the 16th, at around 1 o'clock in the morning, the bodies are brought into the back of the RAC barracks in Killaloe, which for anybody in Killaloe at the moment is to the left of Costcutter, if you're looking at it, that big three-storey building. The left-hand side of that would have been the RAC barracks. So the bodies are thrown into the back of a shed. I use that description deliberately because that was, again, part of the tradition, the way in which the bodies were almost discarded in a shed at the back of the building. The families are informed officially the following day at approximately 3 o'clock, which is a long time when you consider that they were killed the night before. Telegrams arrived to Scariff. News would have came earlier than that, most likely, but certainly officially they received telegrams around 3:30. And again, it's probably important for us to dwell for a brief second on that moment when those telegrams arrived to the families of the four men that their sons have been shot dead in Killaloe. There's an echo from that that'll go on forever within those families. That it immediately shifts then to the families going to Killaloe, of course, naturally, to see the bodies of their brothers and their sons and to bring them home. But the problem is that the British forces refused to release the bodies on the day of the 17th. So from the day of the 17th through to the night of the 18th, there is this constant battle of trying to secure the release of the bodies of the four men. Denham Sparling makes a very important intervention. He's a local Protestant businessman. He has weight in the community and he's able to, I suppose, use in some ways his own Protestant kind of merchant background as leverage to put pressure on the British forces in Killaloe, and he does so. But there are others. Johanna McMahon, who is married to Dennis McMahon, so she's the sister-in-law of Michael Brudd McMahon, plays a role as well in trying to secure the release of the bodies of the four Scariff martyrs, and has been forgotten completely over the years in terms of her role. She had been a nurse in the First World War. She knew regulations. She knew all of that procedural issue. So there is this attempt by the families to go down and get their sons and their brothers back. Obviously, that's only a basic human right. So that adds to the tension and the anger. And that's often, you know, it's obviously embedded in the song, but it's embedded in the story too, that was part of the injury to the community that killed them. Now they wouldn't even release their bodies. But eventually, on the night of the 18th, four carriages with four horses go down to Killaloe to bring home the bodies of the four men, and a large convoy of people go down with them, and there ensues this really remarkable tense moment when at the barracks in Killaloe the British forces refuse to hand the bodies over and want to carry them out themselves into the carriages, and the families refuse to let them carry them, and after a very tense standoff and confrontation, eventually the families are allowed to carry out the bodies themselves and do so. It's been reported as about 1,000 people went down. Certainly a big number of people went down. I'm not sure if it'd be 1,000, but certainly a big number of people were down there. So there was already a big cortege coming back with them. But the evidence would be that certainly as you arrive into places like Ogunlutum Grainy and certainly over to Scariff, there are significant numbers out. Now, we have to remember this is still in curfew, you know, so there would have been obviously some people who'd be nervous about coming out. And of course, as well, you have to remember that this is a really violent and dangerous time. The Black and Tans and RIC follow the cortege. You know, they don't interfere, but they still follow it to kind of maintain that sense of power over them. So this is real tense. This is real violent type of environment. And, you know, not everybody would have been maybe strong enough at that time to associate themselves with that. And they eventually make their way back. They go to the workhouse in Tom Graney, it's described as the Scariff Union Workhouse, to be cleaned up, and then they're moved on to Scariff, where they're put into the church on the night of the 18th. And from then until the date of their burial, the Saturday, 2 days later, they're held in the church in Scariff. Father John Clancy would have been waiting at the foot of Scariff Hill, a number of priests with him, to escort the bodies. So that was almost like the people of Scariff, you know, embracing them from the boundary of their own. So Father Clancy was the man who had to take the responsibility for all of this. And he's a young man from West Clare who, you know, is very much thrown into the centre of all of this real tense environment. He's the one who had to deal with the families, the aftermath of all of that, as well as dealing with the preparations for a funeral that was going to be, you know, the most politically tense funeral in the history of East Clare, without question. So you have this period of time then when the people of Scariff have not certainly a comfortable day and a half with the bodies, because the British forces are constantly coming through the town in that period of time. There's a deliberate escalation of pressure on businesses, for example, in the area, and on anybody associated with it. This type of intimidation is happening on the 19th, which is the day before the funeral, and that all leads itself in then to the actual Saturday, the 20th of November, when the four men are buried.
Are the public able to see them during that time?
When they returned to Scariff Church, there would have been only the families in a position to see their sons and brothers in the church that night, as well as, you know, members of the East Clare IRA and other officials like Dr. Holmes, for example, and Patrick Kalu, the coroner.
On the night of the 18th of November, the East Clare coroner, Patrick Kalu from Tulla, defied the strict curfew and convened an inquest in Scariff Church. Michael O'Gorman explains.
The coffins were open and the local doctor had carried out kind of like post-mortem, if you might call it, you know. And you see, the report had been that these fellows had been shot trying to escape. And the examination of the bodies proved conclusively that each of them had been shot from the front, that none of them had been shot at the back. Each of them had 17 bullet holes, so that they had been shot individually.
So on the 19th, there's an opportunity for people within the community to go to the church and pay their respects to the four men and their families. Now, that obviously has to be controlled and is limited to a degree by the fact that the British forces are in the area. It's very, very tense, but certainly, obviously, a lot of people go to the church, pay their respects, and then preparing all the time for the funeral the following day. Father Clancy is the key guy from the church's point of view, 29-year-old from West Clare. He certainly has to take responsibility from that church point of view. But you then see, like, IRA leaders in the locality and from within the East Clare IRA are taking, obviously, a leading role in the organisation of the funeral. So the IRA leaders, you know, are organising. Pat Hayes from Tom Green, for example, now would have been one of the key guys, you know, Pat MacDonald another, who would have been organising the different elements of the funeral. But then there's the political element, which is usually, in a Republican context, massively important. Now, you have seen in cases like Tomás McCurtain in Cork, Terence McSweeney, who had died, remember, only maybe 2 weeks prior to this, and the funeral has become massively significant. But the British forces are coming down stronger on funerals because they see the funerals have this impact in terms of the community. So you're combating all of that as well. But despite all of that, there's this organisation of a really powerful and significant funeral, added to by the fact the four men are going to be buried within the church grounds, which is not the norm for people outside of the clergy. But you have this offered to the families. And there's really, I suppose, important elements of this as well, where generally Martin Gilday would be buried up in Galway, for example. He's from Galway. It wouldn't be the norm for Michael Egan to be buried in Scariff. So there is to be a decision with the families involved to bury the four men together. Like, the original plan had been for Martin Gilday to be taken back up to New Inn, but Father Clancy and the IRA had a discussion with the family and, you know, made the case that they were killed together, they should be buried together. And it was agreed by the families to allow that to happen and to be buried within the church grounds. There's always been this knowledge, or at least this belief, that there were at least 17 bullets found in each of the bodies, or bullet wounds found in each of the bodies. And that's based on the autopsy undertaken by Dr. Patrick Holmes, overseen by Patrick Callew, the coroner for County Clare. And even though it's an unofficial and illegal autopsy, the IRA arranged for it to take place. Now, both Callew and Holmes would have been connected to the state machinery. Holmes was the official coroner for County Clare, and that was a position filled within the British system of governance, so certain credibility from that point of view that he has in the context of what might be suggested. And then Holmes is the medical practitioner for the British forces in Killaloe as well, so both of those people are not necessarily from within the Republican fold, but they make their assessment and their autopsy, and their findings are disseminated within the community. Holmes' undertaking was an autopsy, a full body autopsy, and he found at least 17 bullet wounds in each of the bodies. That gives us a certain indication of the way that they were killed, and that feeds into the kind of analysis of what might have happened that night. For example, if we were to look at any source we have and we were to say the 17 figure seems somewhat convenient that each of them had 17, but at the same time, if we're even to take that down a little bit and allow for some exaggeration, which I'm not suggesting there was, but if we were to even allow for it, you know, you're still seeing wounds that are not consistent with the way that the British account outlines. British forces arrive as the funeral is taking place. The IRA decide not to fire over the grave on the request of Denham Sparling, because that would have caused, obviously, you know, chaos and violence. But they're there to honour the men.
Liz Gillis, Dublin historian, author and researcher, describes how the events are reported nationally and internationally.
So there were a lot of newspaper reports nationally. The Irish Independent pages were quite full. Every few days there was more about what happened. So you're talking the initial impact of the killings, but then the funerals. So the Independent was reporting on it very sorely. You've got the Liberator, Kerry newspaper, they were reporting on it. The Nina Guardian had quite a bit on it as well. And the Examiner. So all like the big national newspapers did report on the events that happened during that time, not just the immediate killings, but the aftermath of it as well. Who did report on it, and this is very interesting from the Irish perspective, from the Republican perspective, was the Irish Bulletin, and that was the Republican news sheet. So whereas you had all the censorship from being put on the media, so the government control on what was being released. Now, some of them, like the Freeman's Journal, did report what was being said. But to counter the British version of events, the Republican movement set up the Irish Bulletin, which was their newspaper. And the thing about this was, this did go across the world. It was translated into, you know, Spanish, Italian, anywhere you had a Republican consul. Copies of the Irish Bulletin were sent out, and all of that information that was reported in that was gathered locally. It was compiled and distributed up to Dublin, sometimes by members of Cumann na mBan, because they were the ones that could, you know, weren't really suspected of doing anything. And then it was compiled and printed on the run up in Dublin, and then translated and distributed across the world. So you've got, you know, copies being sent, as I said, to France, America, Italy, Spain, as well as across the country in Ireland. So word got out as to what happened that night at Killaloe. The newspapers that I looked at, they're very much coming down in favour of the Republicans. You know, the headlines are quite striking. You know, Clare tragedy, mystery. Now, they do mention the police. They mention that the auxiliaries were based in the Lakeside Hotel. There's a really interesting thing in the Irish Independent on the 19th of November, and that's the banner headline, like, you know, Clare tragedy, mystery, where they were saying that the official version that was given is that these men had tried to escape. But as the reporter saw, that was the most inopportune place to try to escape on the bridge. Why would those men try to escape? So they were reporting what they saw. They weren't actually towing the line. So you could see attitudes were changing by this time, 1920, because I think the major factor in that is, with the arrival of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, they're soon followed by the reprisals. And how many reprisals had happened by November 1920 across the country. Trim, Balbriggan, Renain, all of these towns were affected. So you really couldn't report anything unless you were a really pro-loyalist newspaper, which there were. But the newspapers that maybe would have come down initially on the side of the government were certainly changing their attitudes and reporting actually what was being seen and what had happened. So very, very, very balanced, very balanced.
It's important to consider where all the different accounts are coming from. And, you know, there's a limit to the amount that we have, but there are some really important ones. And one made by Romer C. Gray, who was a former British civil servant living in Ballycogran House in Killaloe, would have been very much traditionally attached to the British machinery of government, would have been from that background that would have aligned himself with British rule. But he certainly gave a damning account of the auxiliaries and of the British forces generally in Killaloe in terms of their behaviour and their impact on the area of Killaloe when they arrived in October, late October 1920. He spoke specifically about the incident of the Scariff Martyrs and accuses them explicitly of murder. So this is a significant statement because of his position, of his connection to British governance, and he's coming out absolutely explicitly in accusing them of murder. His wife is intimidated, the house is raided, her car is stolen by the auxiliaries and the British forces in Killaloe. He ends up having to leave the area as a result of having made that statement, but he left a pamphlet which outlines his position, his experience and his opinion on what took place in November. There's an immediate kind of dismissal of any account that comes from the Republican position because it's seen as propaganda or a bias, or at least that's the way it's presented. And to be fair, from the other perspective, there's nothing believed that comes from the British side. But when you have somebody like R.C. Gray making a statement because he comes across from a position where he, on the face of it, should be aligning himself with the British government, and he comes out and says something so strongly as the auxiliaries are guilty of murder, that has, you know, at least more credibility in some sense from at least the British perspective. But immediately he's dismissed, you know, immediately he's presented as this kind of radical, as this kind of maverick. And that's an attempt, obviously, to undermine his declaration about what happened in Killaloe. Consider the impact of the incident in the short and long term. There mightn't necessarily have been a spike in recruitment for the IRA locally because the membership was fairly well set at that point. I mean, there was a significant membership, a significant mobilisation right from early 1919. So most young men were in the IRA in some fashion, or at least most young men who were going to be useful in a military context were in the IRA already. Certainly emotionally, there would have been much more solidarity with them afterwards. Of course, naturally, for some people, it was fear. I mean, that was, you could argue, some of the motivation for the British forces in any of these acts is to intimidate and to crush, I suppose, the will to support the IRA. We do see certain incidents like the shooting of three British soldiers in February 1921, which one could suggest maybe seen as an act of revenge for what happened in Killaloe. Certainly, you know, the people who shot them would have known the Scariff Martyrs as well, would have been angered by that. That is a possibility. But we see, I suppose, as much intimidation and even more so from the British forces in the period that follows. There's a burning of a shop in January 1921. In April, for example, Father Clancy being pulled from the altar and taken by the auxiliaries from Scariff Church. You know, the official account was that he was offered to go and help his flock that had been, or a road that had been blocked by the IRA. But it did make headlines and was even discussed in the House of Commons in London by Oswald Mosley, you know, who became later a British fascist. He was only 25 at the time, but he confronted Hammer Greenwood about this idea of a Catholic priest in his service being pulled from the altar by military. Part of the aftermath. Killaloe was a really tense area afterwards, and anybody who came into the area from outside tended to be arrested. Tom Hogan, who worked with Sparlings, was arrested when he just drove through the area afterwards. So there was a tremendous tension in the months that followed, right up until the truce of July 1921. But it's difficult to see from either side, is there a direct corollary increase in violence? Is there a direct corollary reduction in attacks? Because, for example, in Glenwood in January 1921, there's a significant ambush where six of the British forces are killed, and Glenwood's only over the road. So there's always been this shifting of activism from September to November 1920, leading up to the killing of the four martyrs. You had this intensity of action around North East Clare, around Scariff, around Feakill, around O'Brien's Bridge, Brawford, etc. But then in the months that follow, it kind of shifts over towards Six Mile Bridge in that area. And that's, I suppose, you see the development of flying columns where the area become that bit more structured, that bit more mobile, that bit more collectivised. And that changes the dynamic of the conflict as well. In November 1921, the first anniversary is held in Scariff and in Killaloe. This is during the truce period, so there's a certain liberty for the Republican movement to honour the four men now properly, and thousands of people come to Scariff to properly honour the men for the first time, I suppose, a year after they're buried. There are shots fired over the grave. In Killaloe at the same time, there's a mark put on the spot where at least the most blood was found, to put it quite frankly. And that formed the spot where 3 years after that in Killaloe, in November 1923, the monument that now is integrated into the bridge was installed for the first time. So you had two sites of memory now. You had Killaloe on the bridge, which was forever a site of memory for the people passing it, connecting it to the four men, and then you had their grave in Scariff forming another site. Now that's reinforced in 1945 when the monument that we now know is installed, and that's fundraised for, significant subscription across East Clare and across the country for it. So you now have two official monuments that are connected to the story. You also, of course, have the East Clare Memorial Park in Tumgraney, which is officially unveiled in 1952, and that becomes a touchstone for the broader East Clare IRA, including the four Scariff martyrs. I know from my research that the East Clare Memorial Committee, in its various forms, is the longest serving memorial committee in the county, if not the country. And it's certainly one of the oldest in the country. And what's critical there is that it illustrates the continual nature of commemoration year on, year on, year on. There is a consistency to commemorative activity around the Scariff Martyrs that is unlike any other event in County Clare.
Councillor Pat Hayes, chairperson of the East Clare Memorial Committee for over 20 years.
I suppose one of my first jobs coming down was to actually say a decade of the Rosary at the Memorial Park 30 years ago. And well, they wanted me to say it in Irish, which was even more difficult at that particular time, and then come over to the Scariff Martyrs and do the similar thing. Like, this is a long tradition going back. We've kept the organisation and kept it going, and we've always put a role of trying to bring back the memories of people that were connected directly with the Scariff Martyrs or the East Clare Memorial Park. And the park is a great vindication to vindicate the work and the people that fought as part of that time 100 years ago.
Tell me a bit about the park opening. Was it for 1952?
Yes, it was, and thousands of people turned up that day. The park in itself is the East Clare Memorial Park, and we've seen the old video footage of it, and it was wonderful to see Tumgraney at that particular time. And I even looked at the records recently again of all the money that was collected locally and nationally and internationally to actually put up this memorial to the people that fought the battle at that particular time. And we looked at all the battalions across East Clare that were very much militarily organised, and there were wonderful organisation skills across East Clare. The other thing about the park, it also had an element of supporting Cumann na mBan. And it was, I think it's one of the few parks in Ireland or memorials in Ireland that actually directly mentions Cumann na mBan as well.
The Scariff Martyrs have been commemorated since, I understand, from the first year after there was a mass at the bridge, and yes, there was a masses in Scariff. Perhaps describe to me the continuation of that commemoration over the years. What would happen?
We have brought it to a kind of an angle where we try and take 15 minutes of the people's time after mass, and we get the mass said in memory of the Scariff Martyrs. When you look at 1916 and look at all the elements around republicanism, they're kind of linked a lot to Easter. We've had special occasions around November, around the 90th anniversary of the Scariff Martyrs, but we've continuously held the event. And there's a weight on your shoulders at times when you stand at that grave and you suddenly realise these are four brave soldiers that were murdered on the bridge of Killaloe and got a torrid time in their murder. And these people were fighting for the freedoms we have now, and for the generations before us and the generations after us. And these are the people that said, we're going to stand up and we'll tolerate no more of this, and pay a heavy price for it. The freedoms that are there today, when we can lay wreaths in their graves and we can bring guests and we can celebrate, is all down to those people. as chair of the group, we've kept the old show on the road because, in fairness to the community of Scariff, when they come out after that mass of an Easter Sunday, the harvest day, we get the lawn piper, Jim reads the proclamation. We make it a bit of an event. People feel good by having remembered that element. I always say to them, give 5 minutes for history. And we do the same in Tungraini at Memorial Park. I feel very proud to be part of this and honoured to be part of an organisation and part of a group here in East Clare that keeps the memories of those people alive.
The dreadful news through Ireland has spread from shore to shore. For such a deed no living man has ever heard before. The deeds of Cromwell in his time, I'm sure no wars could do, than those blackened tans who murdered those 4 youths in Killaloe. 3 of the 4 were on the run and searched for all around, until with this brave Egan in Williamstown was found. They asked him where the boys inside, to the rebels he proved true, and because he would not sell the pass, he was shot in Killaloe. On the 16th of November, that day of sad renown, they were sold and traced through Galway to that house in Williamstown. They never got a fighting chance, but were captured while asleep. And the way that they ill-treated them should would cause your blood to creep. They shackled them, both hands and feet, in twines they could not break, and brought them down to Killaloe by steamer on the lake. Without clergy, judge, or jury on that bridge, they shot them down, and their blood flowed with the Shannon, convenient to the town. They threw them in a lorry like cinders in a heap, and brought them to the barrack yard, and there some days did keep. They kept them closely guarded, so no one could them see, not even those that reared them up from their infancy. With 3 days of perseverance, their bodies they let go. At 10 p.m. their funeral passed through a gonolo. They were kept in Scariff Chapel for 2 nights and a day. Now in that place of rest they lie, kind people for them pray. If you were at their funeral, sure it was an awful sight to see the local clergy, and they all dressed up in white. Such a sight of these young martyrs in one grave was never seen. For they died to save the flag of love, the orange, white and green. Now that they are dead and gone, I hope in peace they'll rest. Like all young Irish martyrs, forever among the blessed. The day will come when all will know who sold their lives away. Of young MacMahon and Rogers, brave Egan and Kildare.
Scariff Martyrs is part of our national story, and the footprints of it are in our locality. So it's just about creating the awareness and shining a light on the connections that are in our community to that story.
You have been listening to Without Clergy, Judge or Jury, the story of the Scariff Martyrs on Scariff Bay Community Radio, with contributions from Tommy Holland from Williamstown, Dr. Tomás MacInmara, oral historian and author, who has spent over 15 years researching the Scariff Martyrs, and is author of The Scariff Martyrs, War, Murder and Memory in East Clare. Michael O'Gorman, Scariff folklorist and major contributor to local history archives. Liz Gillis, Dublin historian and researcher who has published numerous books on the revolutionary period. And Councillor Pat Hayes, chairperson of the East Clare Memorial Committee, with the voice of Noel Hogan, Joan Hanrahan on fiddle and Alan Hogan on vocals. Produced by Carl McNamara and Jim Collins.